Aloha. This is Mary Lane coming to you from the island of Maui, and you are listening to Mina's Journey, a portal into feminine wisdom. My guests and I will be exploring the many flavors of feminine wisdom that is seeping through the cracks of a broken world, inspired by my books, Mina, The Fiery Story of a Heroine's Initiation, Reclaiming Her Authentic Sexual Nature, and her relationship with the Great Mother, and Divine Nourishment, A Woman's Sacred Journey with Food. We will cover many topics, from what is churning in the depths of our souls to practical support in how we can nourish ourselves. Join us as we dive in and fan the flames in the hearts of women and men who are weaving the golden threads of the fabric of love, compassion, and honoring of our Mother Earth and all her relations our world needs to survive. As I get older, a conversation that arises more often than in the past seems to dance around the issue of aging with or without community. I think people have been exploring community living since it rose in consciousness in the 60s. I was around then as well, when we were looking at it from a very different perspective. Now, with so many of us from that era aging and dying, it's amazing how much it is on people's minds. Not just about community living, but preparing for conscious death, surrounded by people who can hold the space for that, and who get who we are, so they can hold the space for us as we transition. Believe it or not, there's a group of us here on Maui who have held a death salon. We call it the Death Salon, which is a circle of friends who meet once a month to go through the process, to put our directives together, decide our five wishes, you know, the practical stuff. And in doing that, have had amazing conversations. It brings up so much on the emotional and spiritual level about our dying. In fact, this coming weekend, I'll be presenting at an international conference that is a death doula training. Doorway into Light is putting on here on Maui. And I'll be talking about how the use of plant medicine can support a conscious death. I have invited my dear friend, Lee Warren, as my guest today, who has been living in the Earth Haven Intentional Community in North Carolina for over 22 years. She knows community living and has devoted her life to doing this in right relationship with the earth. She's an herbalist, homesteader, a writer, a teacher, food and racial justice activist, with an avid interest in rural wisdom, sustainable economics, and women's issues. And she has also just walked by the side of her dear sister and community member as she went through the dying process. Lee is the perfect person to talk story about this sacred topic. A few months ago, she reached out to me with her dear friend, Kim Chi, who is in the dying process, to have a conversation. I was deeply touched by Kim Chi's desire to have not only a conscious death for herself, but for her community. She wanted to make sure it was her final gift to them. You know, I'm actually even kind of tearing up right now. It was an inspiring conversation, and to have someone be that open and mindful about her passing was extraordinary. And since then, Kim Chi has passed. So as an honoring of Kim Chi's death and Lee's commitment to bring this peace into her community, I invited her to share with us about the journey Kim Chi, her, and the community took together as they held her through her transition, so she can support a broader community. I am so honored to have you join me, Lee. particularly at this time, to have this sacred conversation.
Thank you, Mary. What an honor to be here.
Oh, well, I don't even know where to begin, but I want to hear about the journey and how this has affected your life. I'm sure it was huge.
Yeah, there's so many places to enter, right? Do I start at the beginning? Do I start at the end? I think a beautiful place to start is around Thanksgiving of 2016, where Kim Chi had decided at that point, she had been diagnosed maybe a year and a half before with triple negative breast cancer, and which is a particularly aggressive breast cancer. And by August of 2016, she knew that it had metastasized into her lungs, into her liver, into her lymph. And she knew that she wasn't going to fight this in the traditional or the allopathic medical pathway. She felt strongly that that mindset and that model is very much modeled on industry and war, and going to war with the body and going to war with the cancer, which takes the casualty of so many quality things in life, the sanity, the goodwill, the well-being of other beautiful cells in the body, of people's lives, and certainly honoring and trusting anybody who chooses to go that route. I think one of the things we need as sovereign people is to have a whole range of choices. And for Kim Chi, that choice was clear, was a clear path. She did not want to go the route of the allopathic sort of industrial medical route of chemotherapy or radiation, particularly because there was a small chance of beating this cancer as aggressive as it is. So she decided, about in August, she was going to stop seeing her physicians, her oncologist, and, she had been doing some alternative therapy. She was even going to slow down on that. And she sort of headed towards the year's end with a resignation of walking towards her death. And, when Kim Chi and I actually spoke with you on the phone, Mary, that was one of the things that you reinforced for us, was a good death is walking towards it. Doesn't matter what it looks like. Doesn't matter what the details are. Doesn't matter if it's exactly as planned, but are you walking towards it? And Kim Chi decided sometime last fall that she was going to walk towards it. And it's a beautiful and very brave choice. And we laid out a plan along about Thanksgiving, sometime in November. She talked and I typed. And what she wanted, I was able to capture. And she called it the sensuality of dying, or I want to experience an adventure with death firsthand. And that was the title of what she wanted her journey to be. And her intentions were threefold. She wanted to have an ecstatic and delightful death as much as possible. She wanted to unlearn and discover all the things about death that we have not been taught, to the things that have been hidden from us. And she wanted to engage the community and the world in the process. And then she had a bunch of subtasks for that, very specific pieces, which I can get into, but that's the overview. That's the brush strokes of what the kind of intention we're talking about creating. And she pulled it off. I mean, she thought she had longer to live than she did. She ended up dying on February 16th. She thought she had 6 months, and she had more like 3 months, which is a blessing in many ways to not carry on with the suffering. But I think there were some pieces of her end of life that were rushed because it sort of happened so quickly. And I think to just say a little bit about, you know, your question about how did it affect me? I mean, there's a portal that opens into the other world at birth and at death, and probably at some other key points in our lives, that is so expansive and so heart opening, heart and mind opening and spirit opening, that it reverberates and it affects everybody who's around it. Now, there's probably concentric circles of people who are affected, but since I was in the inner circle, it profoundly expanded my life and blessed me in so many, many ways, as I think a good death, and maybe all death, really can. And I'm still, 2 months later, really still integrating and really just still reverberating with the expansion.
Oh my God. I'm almost speechless. Her approach to being able to walk towards this and being able to embrace the fullness of it, the ecstaticness of it, that's about the most courageous thing I've ever heard anyone say or perspective or approach to this passage. And I've been at many deaths, and I know what you're talking about as far as the door opening and the expansiveness and the bath that we end up taking of this amazing energy of divine love is what I've experienced. It's phenomenal, and being able to offer that as a gift to your community is, I think it's like our last gift. It's our mm-hmm. last, final, and probably best gift we can offer. What about as you were walking through the journey with her? Can you share with us about actually how you walked? How did she have you walk through the journey? How did she have the community walk through the journey with her? Did she make, very conscious choices about that? Or I would love to hear about that, because I think as we are opening up to walking towards our death, it would be really helpful to know how she did it with her community. Would you mind sharing that a little bit about that?
No, and I think she would love this. I think she would love that we were doing this interview, because one of the pieces that was really important to her was influencing death culture in a positive way. Those are her exact words. She wanted video, she wanted media, she wanted blogs, she wanted journaling, and we did some of that. There's certain things that happened when she was well, and then sort of as she started getting sicker, the energy started pulling into her closer in circle. So I'll sort of talk a little bit from the bigger picture pieces that she did down to the more intimate. But one of the things that she wanted to do was to go talk to the homeschool children's group about her own death. And so, there's a group of 10 kids or so from between the ages of, say, 2 and I think 7 or 8. And she sat down with these kids and she said, we're going to read this book about, I think it's called Birthing In and Birthing Out, or Borning In and Borning Out. And she read the Borning In, Borning Out book. And she talked about, hey, I'm not going to be in my physical body anymore. What do y'all think of that? And the kids really engaged with her. And she said, when you see a butterfly sometime in the spring and summer, think of me, because I'm going to come back as a butterfly. So she brought in the magical pieces with them, and she brought in some of the physical pieces. And she really wanted to burst this bubble of denial and invisibility, really, in our culture. And she went right to the kids, which was one of the most beautiful things. She also held a solstice party at Yule, at the Christmas holiday time, and it was a big day-long event where she wanted an art mural project where folks could come and get out their emotional process about her dying through art. And so a whole bunch of people came. There was food, there was music, there was dance, there's beautiful pictures of her with lots of people there. And she had only started taking pain medication about mid-December, so she wasn't really in significant decline. The interesting thing about this cancer is that she felt mostly fine until December. Which again, what a blessing. And so she had this big solstice party. She traveled some in December to see family. And then right around the New Year is when she started to need to slow down and be home and, take morphine. And so that, as folks who've been around death and pain management know, that really starts to dull the senses, the oxycodone. And, she called it oxycotton mouth, which was fun and funny. But she, we had sort of as much of a pain management strategy as you can in these things. Hospice is super helpful, but because death and pain and end of life is is sort of regressed or repressed in our culture. We don't have a lot of resources. There's not a bunch of books written. There's not a lot of experts about how to get really creative with pain. How do you use a little bit of this and a little bit of that, or a little bit of homemade stuff or a little bit of that, so you can maximize your own sentience and awareness and consciousness, but also not be in pain. And so, you know, this is just a big experimental process we're in. So once she started being on regular pain meds, she was home more, and there was a circle, basically a circle of care team of women. There were about 10 women who took shifts, and one of the women was the coordinator, and she had all the meals coordinated out. She had all the care shifts. She had all the overnights, big spreadsheet of information. And so this is a beautiful thing. I mean, we live in rural intentional community, but we have computers and we have smart people and we have, you know, people that can jump in. So one of our beloveds, Carmen, was able to coordinate this whole complicated care schedule for her and a dear friend who is actually in decline. Also, she's suffering from ALS and is declining at the very same time. And so folks would show up for their shift and they would cook a meal, or they would be with her for an 8-hour shift, or they would be with an overnight, and they would get downloaded to the meds and downloaded to the, the food details or whatever other details needed to be cared for. And we were in constant contact with each other. So not only did this provide a net of care, of home care for her, it created a more bondedness between all the women who were in the care team circle, and deepened our relationships exponentially through this process. And during this time, what else should I say? The process, even by January, she hadn't actually completed her 5 wishes or her will, which when you talk about your death salon, you know, we're getting it together more to do that. Now we're taking classes and we're doing that now, but we had to scramble in January and sort of do that with her. And thankfully we got it done before she was really slipped into more of the unconscious world. But in terms of the ecstatic pieces, you know, as much as possible, she had song circles at her house. She listened to music. She did collaging. She had delight in the people and the women, mostly the women that were around her. She was a very loving and popular person, so people came to visit all the time. And there was this ongoing negotiation of, gosh, this is draining her. Is this draining her, or is this feeding her? And it was always some of both. And as caregivers, we were navigating that dynamic all the time. But she just was enjoying every minute. And not that, you know, when I say ecstatic deathing, people think, oh, she was not in pain, or she didn't do pain meds, or it was conscious the whole way through, you know. No, it was the same struggles that anybody with cancer who's in pain is dying. We struggled with all that stuff, but we just kept walking as consciously as possible, talking to death, talking to the pain, talking to the illness, talking to each other, not having anything really in the shadows. And just that process of bringing all that shadowy stuff out in front of us was it's so illuminating. It's so freeing. It so brings the wild self into the process that the joy was touchable and tenable and really there, really through the whole process. Another piece that she did is she had a strong say in what she wanted her wake, her funeral, her burial to be, what kind of song she wanted, what she wanted to create. So there was a delightful process around creating that. She got a lot of touch, you know, oxytocin is a beautiful thing that can come at the end of life. And so she wanted to, do oxytocin generation, you know, how can we rub feet and how can we have laughter and how can we have song to sort of accelerate, accentuate, and sort of pump the oxytocin in all of us. And again, not that there weren't stressful moments. The phone was always ringing. Hospice would screw the pharmaceutical order up. It wouldn't show up. We had the wrong this and the bed thing that, you know, there were problems. And in and around that, we could remember the intention and the passion of this precious, precious few, you know, hours and days and weeks that we had with her. And so that kept us staying open and staying connected.
Beautiful. Beautiful. It sounds like a model to me. of how to die consciously. There's so much work going on this island, including this big conference around conscious dying. And as much as I have heard about it and the death salon and all of this, the actual experience that you actually walked through it in this way, it's one thing for us to sit in a conference and at a death salon and talk about it. And it's another thing to hold that energy all the way through. It's almost as if you could also bring the ecstaticness into the grief. It's like the love and the grief and the ecstasy were all woven together from what I'm listening to here. And it almost, you know, and that feels like a wholeness where nothing is disconnected. You're not disconnected from any of it. You're not disconnected or nothing's in the shadows. And that to me is the ecstasy from what I'm listening to. And I wish you were speaking at this conference because the actual walking through it, I mean, it's the way you do everything, Lee. You know, everybody talks about intentional community, but you've been doing it. And people talk about sustainability, but I know you. You've been doing it. You actually live it. And this is another great example of you just really living it. I'm so deeply touched. I'm so deeply touched by your commitment to it. And thank you. And for sharing this. And
I'd love to share a little more about her post-death process. I think folks would be really interested in that piece too, if there's time and space
for
that.
There is time. I want you to share all that you want to share. Yeah.
Yeah, so this is one of the most beautiful pieces that I think I can share. And we haven't really touched so much on intentional community, but I think the built relationships that many of us have had with each other, all the women that were caretakers, and then I'd say the circles out from there, the men actually who dug the grave, and the community, you know, that were maybe less personally close to her, but the whole thing was just held in these sort of nested bowls of love and goodwill and care. And part of that is that people in our tradition and in our community study different traditions. We like to encourage a sense, an atmosphere which diverse spiritual practice can thrive and be honored. So there is no one spiritual practice in our eco-village, but we want to see people follow their passions and really encourage that. And so we pulled together so many of these beautiful traditions that are studied by members of our community. And I'd love to just weave that in some ways into a story for you to see how we handled the post-death process. So we've been studying for many years with a woman named Soban Fusome, who also recently passed herself and is now in the ancestor world. And she is from the Dogara tradition. She's from the Dogara tribe in West Africa. And she teaches something called the grief process and the grief ritual. And she taught us how to set up altars and tend the dead and be with our grief. So that's been a many years journey for many of us, is this Dogara tradition and grief ritual tradition. So that helped inform us setting up the altars. And the ancestor altar, the grieving altar, and the altar where kimchi was laid out in a beautiful, beautiful way where people could come over the 3 days of the wake and be with her body and be with her things and be with her art. That was such a beautiful tradition. We also have the Mayan tradition, which many of our members have been studying with a man named Martin Prechtel, and they weave their death traditions into their agriculture traditions, where they grow corn for people who are born. They grow corn for people who die. And so the idea is that the person who dies goes back to the earth and then comes back to us as the sacred corn process. So part of what we did in the process of washing her body and wrapping her body after death was we put a corn in her belly button and wrapped that. And then people at the funeral who were committed to to growing this corn for the season, we'll be growing it in honor of her. And then 9 months after this, after her death, we'll come together and have another tradition with this corn that was grown in honor of her and actually on her grave itself. So that's such a beautiful tradition woven agriculturally, cosmologically, and socially through our systems now. We have a Lakota tradition that people practice, and we did lots of ritual Lakota song and smudge smoke of cedar around the edges of the whole ritual. And those people who studied that tradition brought that beautiful piece. We've also been studying with a beautiful, beautiful group here in Asheville, North Carolina, near where we live, called the Center for End of Life Transitions. And these are women in the Buddhist tradition who have been informing and mentoring us around how to be with the body, how to speak to the person when they die and for 3 days afterwards, and not bury until after 72 days, and to tell the story of the person over there with their body, and as the body is being washed, and the care and the love that goes into the dead, and to the process of moving from the dying to the dead to the buried. And we had those women by our side, really helping us fill out the death certificate, the practical world things, as well as the spiritual pieces. And I'd say the last and maybe most important or most foundational tradition that we have studied, many of us, is the wise woman tradition, mm-hmm. which is the sacred and ancient art of women's mysteries, which is that move in women almost instinctively, the deep care that was given by the caregivers out of this heartful and embodied place, because women wanted to be near her and care for her towards the end of her life. And it brings us the traditions of just the intuitive knowing of what someone needs in the decline, and the circle of care that was built between the caregivers. All of this comes to us from the wise woman tradition. And as we relearn how to nourish ourselves and get rest ourselves and integrate these practices into our lives. So the piece that I love to tell about is that all of these truths were blended here in the best possible way. None were in conflict, all in concert. And this is the new age. This is the new world. This is the new cosmology that we need to do, which is these traditions aren't in conflict. These traditions are a synthesis and a synergy. And when they can come together in service to life and in service to death, we sort of see the best in humanity.
Mm. Well, it reminds me of none of this is in conflict in nature. And as we come back to the natural world as a teacher, which is very much at the core of all these traditions, we find that it's all in harmony. It's all, none of it is in conflict, which I think is really beautiful. So what you're doing is, as you're living a more of a rural existence in community, you're starting to embody, as time goes on, more and more of the natural intelligence. That's what it sounds like to me. And you're embracing it, all of it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm doing a lot of this post-death taxes and paperwork and all the sort of logistical world governance bureaucracy pieces. And so I have to call these agencies and I say, you know, I'm the executor, or I'm the dear friend and she died. And, you know, they get very somber. They get very sad. They say, I'm sorry. You know, and it's great that these people are trained to even acknowledge death. But, you know, one of my pieces is to say back to them is, thank you so much for acknowledging that. And it's been a remarkably beautiful process. And can I tell you that it was ecstatic in every possible way? You know, because I think people immediately go to the, oh, they want to shut down. They want to feel bad. They have, you know, sad or bad or dark feelings. And I think, you know, the paradigm shift here is we all have to die. We all have a death process, whether that's fast or whether that's slow. Can we enjoy that? Can we make that as amazing as possible? Why wouldn't we do that? Why would we make it a sad or bad or depressing process? Let's make it as fun as possible. If we're gonna do it, let's go there. So, you know, as much as possible, just gently and quickly, I just say to people, you know, it was a beautiful process, and it's a blessed thing you know, so to just try to influence the heaviness that we have around this.
I think that's a really important piece, and that's why I'm so, at this time in my life, I'm so focused in on that piece, because it goes with walking towards your death. And why wouldn't it be that time in history or time in our lives where it's so filled with all of it, like what you said, all of it, it's all woven in. And what that looks like and feels like is just the pure love that's available for all of us. And there's something about this. It's like I keep feeling like it's not really a death, but it's a birth into something. And we're celebrating the birth, not just, you know, a death of something. It's the birth of something. If we can keep that in mind, that we're birthing into something, and we celebrate that, don't we? You know, we celebrate the birth of a baby. Why would we not celebrate the birth into something, you know, a different existence, a different experience for the soul?
That's what Kim Chi would say often, which is, this is the death of my body, and I'm onto new projects. I'm onto new adventures. I'm onto new endeavors, you know, and I'm sure she had her doubts. I'm sure she had her waverings or her confusion. We don't know what is on the other side, but it was clear to her, you know, and the evening of her death, she died about 8 p.m. Her death timing was really like uncanny. She died on February 16th. Her birthday is on February 20th. So with the 3 days, the 72 hours of sitting wake, she was buried on her birthday, on her 57th birthday, which was just, and we sang her happy birthday in the grave. I mean, it was just sort of uncanny. And maybe divinely ordered by Kim Chi herself, because that's her style. She was a magical, miraculous being. But the evening that she died, you know, I was headed to bed many hours later, and I had this vision and this image of a million gold shimmers coming out from her and spreading out all around the village, all around the region, and that we were all getting showered with this gold shimmers of her essence. And then over the next few days, we started giving away her stuff. So basically all her stuff started going into the hands of, you know, many, many, many people. Beautiful tapestries she had, and artwork, and baskets, and beautiful clothing, and some of her writings and journals. And so this sort of physical manifestation of her stuff getting scattered was also the image that I had of her essence being scattered, like the gold and beautiful essence of her soul shimmering into, you know, a million parts, and we all got some of that. And I sense that, and I feel that from a personal perspective, like I got a part of her. It's in me now. It's hard to put words to it, because it's such an ethereal concept, but there's really parts of her essence in me that are guiding me and shaping me in the world, that she gave to me in her death, as she did give to everybody else in the valley, in our village, and the people she loved throughout the world. So something magical is happening there. And I think because we are so left-brained, we don't have as much understanding or language or literacy for this, because this is not where we spend a lot of our mental energy and time. But I do think there's way more than we can know, that we do know, and that we can know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And as you're sharing this, as you're talking, I'm feeling it's almost as if Kim is still spreading that golden essence out even further through you right now.
Right.
And I'm feeling it. It's like it didn't stop there. And every time you share, Lee, every time you share, she's doing that.
I believe that too.
Yeah. Oh, honey, this is just such a beautiful story. I hope this really inspires many people.
Yeah, I want to say that, you know, Kimchi was an extrovert, you know, extrovert extraordinaire. And I've often thought, you know, because we have so few models and because we have so few examples, when we hear them, we think, oh, I should do that, or let me do it this way. And, you know, it's been interesting. It's been inspiring me to think deeper about, you know, I wouldn't have created the same death because I'm more of an introvert, or I'm more of a one-on-one person. She had people around her all the time. She had rituals. She had visitors. I mean, it was a nonstop revolving door. And I think, gosh, you know, I would want beautiful aspects of the things that she modeled, but I would want way more solitude, or way more one-on-one, way more sacred space. I wouldn't want the phone ringing. I wouldn't want the constant visitors, you know? And so I think the point to say to your listeners and to remind all of us is, this is an individual journey. Let us make this as sacred and beautiful as possible with our own signature. What, you know, and how can we spend some time not only thinking about the five wishes, which, if folks don't know, is a system that's been developed to help us figure out end of life directives or living will processes. How do we want to be treated if we are incapacitated? And not only getting that in order, but the will in order. So I don't want to neglect or negate any of the real physical world, legal, financial
Correct.
Processes, all of which really need to get done. But I think at the same time, or to think about in the same way, is like, what do I want my sacred journey to look like? And it probably is going to look a little bit like how we've lived our lives, I would guess, you know, modeled on our personalities and our inclinations and our preferences. And so to imagine that we could create something that's wholly unique to us, and then ask the people around us to meet us there, because more than anything else, those of us who were caring for her felt honored to be asked. And that is the beautiful thing that death brings. It gives us an opportunity to give. And if the one thing that we can learn to train and build the muscle in ourselves towards when we move towards our death is learning to receive, because there will be no shortage of people who want to give. We have to get good at receiving. And if we set it up ahead of time about what exactly we personally want it to look like, then the people around us who are giving are going to be better able to meet our needs, because they will know what it is we want to create.
Well, that was actually the point of the death salon, is that we created a circle around us that through these discussions and time together talking about this, we all were able to get clear on what's right for us. What do we want? And in the process, we created a circle around us that went through our own self-discovery of what is right for each of us. And so, and then we have a circle around that knows that really has a deep sense of what it is for each of us. So I think what I'm tapping into here is the confirmation of being able to create what it is that embodies my essence. What is it that, how do I exit in a way that is truly the way, reflects the way I was designed, you know, yeah, on every level in this lifetime, in this incarnation, and offer that as a gift. And what you're describing is the, it's more willingness than I've ever heard, really, by anybody. I've heard a lot of people talk the talk, but I've not heard of anybody walk the walk as clearly as this, of really doing this in this way.
Well, I think part of the...
That's what I want. That's what I want to aspire to. That's what I want to be able to do, whatever it is that I need to let go of, to be able to actually do that for myself and my beloveds.
Beautiful. Yeah, I think the secret sauce there, the secret ingredient, is shared reality with people around you. And I think bringing that back full circle to the intentional community conversation, which is Kim Chi had invested 20 years of her life into a community where she had shared reality with people and joint vision, and had lots of opportunities to bond deeply around many, many aspects of life and death. And so that when this process came, the container was already built. The ship was built and we were on it. There was no, you know, if she had had, for example, more medical needs than we could take care of, and she had to go, for example, to a family member's, she wouldn't have had that kind of death, because that family member would not have had that shared reality or that embodied sense of who she was and what she wanted. And so again, I think the secret ingredient in this context is surround yourself with people who are willing to help you have the death you want, because it's not a solo journey.
No, it takes us right back to where we started on this conversation when I opened this up, which is a beautiful full circle, which, God, Lee, thank you so much for sharing this. And we're almost out of time. And I want to say that, you know, if you want to hear or go to Lee's website, go to the podcast page on my website, minasjourney.com, and you can learn more about her intentional community and maybe learn more about, I don't know, do you have any more information up there about Kim Chi's journey that maybe they can tap into and, connect in with Lee on some level if you want to, or people in her community that can support you and maybe counsel you a little bit on this. And before we have to leave, is there anything else you think Kim Chi would like to say to a broader community at this time and pass on?
That's a tall order to channel her or to speak, to imagine. Let's see. I think she would say embrace the journey of deathing, because it can be a very heightened experience. Not that there's not fear, not that there's not challenges, but that just really, let's change culture here. Let's change the storyline. Let's get empowered and ecstatic and delighted by our own processes, and in the process develop some mastery about being human and dying as humans. So I think that would be her encouragement.
I'll take that. Bless you.
Thank you, Mary.
Bless you for living this very needed lifestyle. It feels like it is truly an example of a return to the mother and supporting others to do the same. And I can't thank you enough for sharing, your journey with Kim Chi's and this very sacred time in your life. And I'm sure you're still integrating and will for a very long time. What an incredible gift she gave you. And thank you for passing that gift along to others.
Yeah. And thank you, Mary, for being holding space for this podcast and for being literate enough and, leading the way and pioneering this. You've been a teacher and a mentor and a leader for us in this process as well. So thank you so much.
Thank you, honey. So, aloha.
Aloha.
Thank you for joining us today. I hope you find these conversations supportive, nourishing, and inspiring. I also hope they invite you to buy and read my books, Mina and Divine Nourishment. Both are available on Amazon in paperback and Kindle versions. You can help spread the word by subscribing, rating this podcast, and writing a review on iTunes so others are inspired to join in. You can also subscribe on my website, minasjourney.com. Receive a notification in your inbox every 2 weeks that includes who my next guest is and the focus of our topic, with a link to the next episode on iTunes. If you'd like, you can submit comments, questions, and insights on my website as well. And my guests and I will do our very best to explore them in our following episodes. Lastly, I want to thank Liam Selwyn for his beautiful original music piece, Human Wind Chimes, he has kindly contributed to this podcast. This is Mary Lane, and I thank you once again for joining my guests and I today, and I hope you will join us again for the next episode. Aloha.